The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The Strange Beauty at the Edge of the Everglades, chronicling the historic struggles of the Florida farming community known as Belle Glade. In the thick of the Everglades, near the southern shore of Lake Okeechobee, Belle Glade once had a frontier character formed by a handful of people who contended with the sawgrass and mosquitoes and caught catfish and spoke their own patois. The settlement sprang to prominence in the 1920s after engineers had dug canals to drain the vast wetlands and a railroad arrived. Farmers and corporations planted acres and acres of green beans, sugarcane, corn, bell peppers, tomatoes, celery, and more. Field bosses hired Haitians and Jamaicans to cut cane, and black Southerners, Puerto Ricans, and others came to pick vegetables. Though big money flowed behind the scenes, poverty was the rule for workers, and living conditions could be brutal. In the late 1930s, Marion Post Wolcott photographed those problems. Children living in a lean-to of rusty galvanized tin and burlap. The CBS News documentary, Harvest of Shame, broadcast in 1960, publicized the exploitation of the seasonal workers. Today, Belle Glade is home to 20,000 people, about 60% of them black, 32% Latino, and 41% residents live in poverty. Sophia Valiente lived in Belle Glade for several years, beginning in 2015. She wanted to show people at work and at home, old and young, in all their humanity in this struggling community. Her book, For Everglades, juxtaposes her photographs with rustic stories by Lawrence Will, a businessman and self-described cracker historian who moved to the area in 1913. Valiente also created a traveling photography exhibition. One of her muses for the project was Zora Neale Hurston, an Alabama native who lived in Belle Glade in the 1930s while writing her landmark novel of African American life, Their Eyes Were Watching God, which pays some tribute to the bean pickers who work all day for money and fight all night for love. There are several pictures to go with this, and I'll read the captions. Close up of the ground. Custard apple trees, a freshwater version of mangroves, once ringed Lake Okeechobee's southern shore in a 3-mile-wide belt. Today, barely 100 acres remain. Smoke hangs in the air from the controlled burn of a sugarcane field prior to cutting. A man named Antonio holds a rabbit he has killed and intends to sell. In the upper corner, fresh speckled perch, a type of sunfish, caught in the nearby canals for $5 per plastic bag. And a picture with a dust cloud. The caption reads, in Belle Glade, seasonal migrant workers are often housed in rooming houses like this one, an apartment building with single rooms and shared bathrooms. The swamp was dismal and damp, but after some stumbly walking, we came to a little glade deep in the woods near the lake. Here's a picture of an airboat. No story about the Everglades or Lake Okeechobee area would be complete without a picture of an airboat. Mike Galatzian ferries tourists around Lake Okeechobee by airboat. Now abandoned, Creamer Island was a site where families grew green beans and corn. Here's a picture of a crop dusting airplane coming straight at the camera over a field. The crop dusting operation near Belle Glade Airport is owned by pilot Jesse D. Lee, whose grandfather homesteaded on nearby Torrey Island in 1905. At their grandmother's birthday party, sample homemade pickled eggs and sausage she brought to the celebration. And here's a picture of a little girl back against the wall with a high window above and a cat sitting on the window looking outside. Belgrade resident Alexia, at the time top student at Pioneer Park Elementary, has moved on to advanced classes at Lakeshore Middle School. Then there's a picture of a map, and the caption says, a 1924 advertisement offered land in the Glades at $24 an acre. Today, a farmland acre costs $10,000 to $12,000, depending on location and depth of the soil. A picture of a young lady, a contestant of some sort, brandish leafy pom-poms of chicory, a major cash crop at the time. And lastly, a picture of a shipwreck of sorts. In waters off Belgrade lies the 1880 shipwreck of a dredge boat used in a first attempt to excavate a canal from Lake Okeechobee to Miami. The effort failed. And the author of this is Sophie Valiente. Up next, why a newly installed statue of Marilyn Monroe is so controversial. In the era of Me Too, some view the sculpture, now on view in California, as a symbol of sexism. The Forever Marilyn statue's June 20 unveiling attracted protesters who view Seward Johnson's 26-foot-tall sculpture as an outdated symbol of sexism. Photo by Frederick Brown, by Tara Wu. This past weekend, a 26-foot-tall likeness of Marilyn Monroe was installed outside the Palm Springs Art Museum in Southern California. Though the actress smiles as a gust from a underfoot air vent makes her white dress fly up, an homage to a scene in the 1955 comedy The Seven-Year Itch, not everyone in the city is happy about her presence. The dedication event for the statue, which is titled Forever Marilyn, drew hundreds of attendees, many of whom came to protest the work's unveiling. The crowd's nonstop chants, both for and against the sculpture, were enough to drown out some of the ceremony speakers, reports Jory Finkel for the Art newspaper. Fierce debate has surrounded the statue in the months leading up to its unveiling on Museum Way. According to James B. Cutchin of the Desert Sun, some opponents argue that the city did not obtain residents' approval before moving it from a still-under-construction downtown park to its current location at the museum. Detractors also point out that the statue obstructs Museum Way, the long-sought, newly-installed viewing corridor, and blocks access to the beloved cultural institution. She was meant to be here forever in the park, and that's what's upset us. Nikki McLaughlin, leader of the Committee to Relocate Marilyn, tells the Desert Sun, to close a street that was specifically created to open up the museum is what we have a problem with. Forever Marilyn was inspired by a scene from the 1955 comedy The Seven-Year Itch. Protesters' objections extend beyond simply the statue's location. Some feel that the artwork is exploitive, an outdated symbol of sexism. Chapters of the Women's March Foundation, as well as other local organizations, joined the committee to voice their opposition to the plan this weekend. The past four directors of the Palm Springs Art Museum have all publicly opposed the statue's location, too, according to the Art newspaper. It's a battle for the identity of Palm Springs, says Liz Armstrong, who led the museum from 2014 to 2018. She said that to Pat Saperstein of Variety. How does it represent this city, this placement of her gigantic panty-clad rear end being the first thing you see when you come out of the museum is so disrespectful. It's such a slap in the face. To WMF, the statue represents the sexual objectification of an iconic woman in the era of Me Too. The 26-foot-tall statue of Marilyn Monroe is designed for viewers to walk in between the legs. Snap a picture for fun. The organization's executive director, Emiliana Gureka, explains to NBC Los Angeles, it is sexist, exploitive, and misogynistic. Even in death, Marilyn has no peace. We are demanding the statue be moved. It has no place in Palm Springs. A GoFundMe campaign organized by the Relocation Committee has raised more than $70,000 for an ongoing lawsuit against the City of Palm Springs and PS Resorts, the Hotels Association organization that bought the statue for $1 million in 2020. On change.org, a separate petition calling to move the statue has garnered 41,000 signatures and counting. During the dedication, Aftab Dada, chairman of Palm Springs Resorts, argued that the presence of the statue created by sculptor Seward Johnson in 2011 would help draw tourists and boost revenue for local businesses, an especially pressing concern in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the Desert Sun, Forever Maryland previously stayed in Palm Springs from 2012 to 2014. Dada recounted that its stay brought the city millions and millions of dollars in publicity. Palm Springs was supposedly a site of significance to Monroe. Per the Palm Springs Bureau of Tourism, Bruno Bernard, the pinup photographer who later captured the image that inspired Forever Maryland, introduced her to Johnny Hyde, vice president of the William Morris Agency at the Palm Springs Racquet Club in 1947. For this reason, it's generally claimed Marilyn Monroe was discovered in Palm Springs, the Bureau notes on its website. Other sources suggest differently. History.com, for example, says she was discovered while working in a California munitions factory during World War II. Today, Monroe is widely hailed as a feminist icon, in the words of biographer Michelle Morgan. Although vulnerable and complex, Marilyn was a strong woman who consistently fought for what she believed in. While the city has called the installation of the statue temporary and stated that its agreement with the Palm Springs Resorts only lasts 3 years, Trina Turk, another leader of the Relocation Committee, tells the Art newspaper the group plans to continue protesting. Next, the forgotten French scientist who courted Thomas Jefferson and got pulled into scandal. A decade before Lewis and Clark, André Michaud wanted to explore the American continent. Spying for France gave him that chance. By Sean Assail, A-S-S-A-E-L. In December 1792, a 46-year-old French botanist named André Michaud arrived in Philadelphia to visit with some of the city's most influential citizens. Michaud had spent much of his adult life sloshing around muddy rivers and hacking through mosquito-infested forests, but he could clean up and turn on the charm when it suited his purposes, as it did when he paid a call on Benjamin Rush, the physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, and Rush's colleague, Benjamin Barton, a well-known naturalist. Both men belonged to the American Philosophical Society, the nation's foremost scientific organization, which had been founded 50 years earlier to promote useful knowledge. Michaud, the educated son of a farmer, told Barton that it would be useful for the United States to have geographical knowledge of the country west of the Mississippi. His words were dry, but the idea was explosive. He wanted to transform the American continent, and with it, his own reputation, by becoming the first explorer to forge a path to the Pacific. Barton relayed Michaud's idea to the Society's vice president, Thomas Jefferson, who also happened to be the U.S. Secretary of State. Jefferson's obsession with the frontier west of the Mississippi River was well known. His library at Monticello had more books about it than anywhere else on earth, filling his head with visions of woolly mammoths and purple volcanoes. More important, he viewed uniting the ends of the continent as destiny, a prerequisite for creating an American empire of liberty. Up next, the pandemic showed what can be done without parachute science. With international scientists barred from traveling, local scientists in the Pacific Islands are taking the chance to lead. Recent research has shown that most scientific papers on coral biodiversity are led by people in high-income countries with few coral reefs. By Ashley Braun. This article is from Hakai, H-A-K-A-I, magazine, an online publication about science and society and in coastal ecosystems. Read more stories like this at HakaiMagazine.com. Fringed by vibrant coral reefs, Fiji is a popular destination for international tourists and marine scientists. But when the COVID-19 pandemic arrived last year, forcing lockdowns and travel restrictions around the world, many, though not all, international field research projects ground to a halt. Through its abrupt absence, the dominance of a practice known as parachute science was highlighted by the clampdown. In Fiji, as in other lower-income countries, parachute science occurs when international scientists, often from wealthier nations, travel to a country to complete field work, and then they leave without meaningfully engaging with local researchers or communities. With flights grounded and borders closed, Fijian coral reef ecologist Sangeeta Mangabai suddenly wasn't fielding constant requests for foreign collaboration. And she wasn't spending her time tracking with international academics who might be swooping into her field sites and quickly publishing papers on issues that she had been gathering data on for years and working to bring it to communities and decision makers. Since 2014, Mangubai has been leading coral reef monitoring efforts as the director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Fiji office. She can easily list half dozen ways foreign scientists have gone around and even dismissed her and her team. Some blithely fly to Fiji with predetermined research priorities and fail to learn about her team's existing work or their needs, she says. Others add a local scientist to a foreign research proposal at the last minute, a tokenistic inclusion that implies there is no genuine interest in collaboration, and we are a tick box for them to say they have local partners and get funding for themselves. Mangubai says, other times fully qualified local scientists work on international collaborations are relegated solely to collecting data, in other words, doing manual labor rather than analyzing data or writing manuscripts. Mangubai says she doesn't know if scientists exhibiting parachute behavior are intentionally manipulative or just naive, just clueless about how colonial their approaches to working with us are. Seychellois marine scientist Sheena Talma is all too familiar with the problem. In a recent paper, she and her colleagues showed the academics publishing the most scientific papers on coral biodiversity and are mainly based out of high-income countries with few or no coral reefs. Over time, negative experiences with foreign scientists have made Mangubai increasingly protective of her staff and their research. She says she has to evaluate possible partnerships to avoid those predatory scientists who come in and strip information from our country just to profit their own career. But with so many research trips canceled because of the pandemic, Mangubai and her peers found new opportunities in the research landscape because they were no longer subjected to this problematic practice. One opportunity came in the form of a unique Pacific Islander research collaboration led by the locally managed Marine Area Network International, an association of community-based marine conservation practitioners in the Indo-Pacific. and Gubai's team, along with nonprofit World Fish and the Australian National Center for Ocean Resources and Security, quickly designed and implemented a study focused on the impacts of the pandemic on the Pacific. They developed a rapid response survey designed to assess how COVID-19 was affecting 181 villages across seven Pacific island countries. On top of the pandemic, Fiji was hit in April 2020 by Tropical Cyclone Harold, a Category 4 storm that displaced 6,000 and racked up $22.6 million in damage. For Fiji, the survey helped illuminate the combined efforts of the pandemic and cyclone on issues like hunger, livelihoods, fishing practices, and gender equity. More broadly, it allowed the collaborators to put real data into the hands of government officials in the countries they surveyed. Socioeconomic studies like this would often be the focus of parachute scientists who can easily fly in and out after a disaster, Mangubai says. But taking the lead on this type of work encouraged some Pacific Islanders who don't come from a traditional academic background to step up in new ways, she says, allowing them to contribute to data analysis and scientific manuscripts and receive rare formal recognition as authors on those papers. We have a really amazing, young, dynamic woman from Fiji that really has just been driving the energy for it, Mangubai says. It's been quite empowering for everyone to see how capable we are. Still, with COVID-19 vaccinations on the rise and travel plans along with them, many researchers are likely to return to the field and to old habits. In their paper about parachute science in coral biodiversity research, Talma and her colleagues laid out recommendations to reverse these trends. For example, they suggest that scientists in high-income countries develop joint research agendas with local collaborators early in a project. Establish programs to invest in early career researchers in low-income nations, and share their copies of key academic papers with colleagues working in places with limited access to scientific literature. While Talma is encouraged by the number of researchers contacting her about how to act on the ideas from this paper, she says she hasn't seen much difference on the ground in Seychelles. I think in most scientists' minds, this is temporary, she says of the pandemic's effects. Perhaps what is changing is the fact that parachute science is being put in the spotlight. Still, there are signs of progress. Emily Darling, a Toronto, Ontario-based biologist who runs the Wildlife Conservation Society's Global Coral Monitoring Program, says the pandemic's interruption has been a wake-up call. It has prompted her and others working at global environmental nonprofits to re-examine how research is undertaken to develop new processes and tools to empower local scientists and to focus on decarbonizing and decolonizing their work. This is an opportunity to recalibrate what we do, and we should take it, she says. But I really do miss coral reefs. Up next, Rising Again, a Colossus of the Sky, the California condor, nearly gone when biologists rescued it from extinction. Then came the raging fires and a terrible new challenge. The leaden sky above Big Sur looks as uninviting as cold oatmeal. The temperature is about 40, and tracing lazy circles on an updraft is a kettle of California condors. Wings fanning out at the tips like splayed fingers, the enormous creatures have whirled gracefully over Julia Pfeiffer Burns State Park for hours, now and then giving a couple of deep flaps. Every time I spot a condor, it's like I'm seeing one for the first time, says Joe Burnett, a senior biologist with the Ventana Wildlife Society in Monterey, and program manager for the California Condor Recovery Program. I'm like, I didn't know there was a bird this big, that still existed. Through his binoculars, the vulture's fearsome appearance, fleshy heads and spiky ruffs, flame-red eyes, make them seem enigmatic and prehistoric, as if they were designed by a committee of paleontologists. Barnett has monitored Big Sur's flock since Ventana, the only nonprofit in the state that prepares captive-bred condors for life in the wild, began releasing the rare imperiled raptors in these canyons 24 years ago. They have similar traits to us, he says with a rueful chuckle. They're slow breeding, very social, and can live about 80 years, though they average about 60. Sounds like I'm talking about a mammal, not a bird. But that's why I love working with them. As we clamber up a trail on Marble Peak, Burnett spies a condor roosting in a tangle of branches atop a ponderosa pine, a spectacular bird with a wingspan of almost 10 feet. It stands there puffing out its chest like a Best Actor nominee on Oscar night. Suddenly, we're eclipsed by the shadow of another condor soaring overhead. I think they purposefully track their shadow on the ground. Burnett says they're marking you in a way, that is, giving you a heads up that they can know you're here and that they can fly and you can't. It happens so often that I'm almost convinced that they are just monkeying with us, which would be fitting. For hundreds of years we've been monkeying with them. Of all that human monkeying, perhaps none inflicted more harm on condors than the wildfire set by an arsonist in an illegal marijuana grow that swept through Ventana's 80-acre condor sanctuary last August. The so-called Dolan Fire, which consumed 125,000 acres along the Big Sur coast and injured 19 firefighters, incinerated pens, razed the research building, and displaced 101 free-flying birds. For two tense weeks, biologists were cut off from the preserve, keeping tabs on survivors by electronic transmitter. When the sanctuary was deemed safe to re-enter, Burnett confirmed his suspicions. 11 condors had died, including 2 chicks in nests. Because the chicks were only a few months old, the size of the chickens, but still covered in down, they were too young to fly and escape the fire, Burnett says. Another condor, an adult, had suffered severe burns to its beak, legs, and crop, and underwent multiple surgeries. It was euthanized in January. And that's a sign our time is up. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. Address any concerns or comments to us at 919-832-5138.